funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is it that the most numerous and diverse group of animals on the planet goes mostly unnoticed and generally unappreciated by most human beings? While many of us are sympathetic to the plights of whales and seals and the Barton Springs salamander, we tend to have a much more complicated relationship to the world's 935,000 species of insects. We're well aware of the bugs that eat our crops and nip our skin, but we often fail to celebrate the vital role of those that fertilize our plants, gobble our waste, and feed larger animals, including human beings. But my guest today finds insects and our view of them endlessly fascinating and shares what he has learned in his most recent book. Hugh Raffles is professor of anthropology at the New School. His book, Insectopedia, has just been released in trade paperback. Hugh, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's great to be here.
There is no question that insects are some of the most fascinating and important creatures on the planet, and most of them are pretty harmless to humans.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we so freaked out?
Good question, isn't it? That was something that I tried to figure out in writing the book, and I'm really still not sure why. I think my feeling now is that it's because they're so different from us, and because unlike most animals, we have very few ways of making sense of them or feeling close to them. There's a few species that we do that we can identify with in some way, like bees and the more beautiful ones like butterflies. But generally, they're just so alien from us that it's very difficult for us to feel a connection with them.
You have a very short chapter called Beauty that describes an experience you had living in Brazil in the mid-90s. Can you talk about what happens when migrating butterflies come through?
Yeah, I was doing research in a small village in the at the mouth of the Amazon. I'd been living there for quite a long time, and the village was really a group of houses spread out along the river. And we were out on the boat, and when we came back, all the houses looked completely different. They were just covered in these golden yellow butterflies. It was really, really very beautiful and very dramatic and unexpected, too. And thousands and thousands and thousands of these yellow butterflies come in for a few days, and they just cover all the houses and the yards around the houses as well. And everything's just suddenly transformed, you have no idea. And then after a day or so, they go on. It looks very, very beautiful, but actually what they're attracted by is all the animal waste around the houses. That's what they're drawn to, and they settle on that. So when you inquire a little bit, it's not as romantic as it seems at first, but it's very, very beautiful to look at.
And the other chapter that you have called Kafka, course people remember the story Metamorphosis, reminds us what a miracle it is that this process ever takes place. Is it right that less than 1% of caterpillar eggs actually fully develop?
As I understand it, that's right, yeah. And it really is very mysterious how these caterpillars, these larvae, change into these, completely different animals. They're, when they're caterpillars, they're asexual, and then when they're butterflies, they're really actually all about reproduction. They eat leaves when they're caterpillars. When they're butterflies, they sip nectar. They they're earthbound when they're caterpillars. They fly when they're and barely settle at all when they're butterflies. They're just completely different beings in every way. And then there's this process of transformation where all their entire bodies get reorganized. And we often think of them only in the adult stage. We pay attention to them as butterflies and actually ignore them as caterpillars. One of the things that got my attention when I started to think about that was that the first field guide to North American caterpillars had just come out. And it seemed amazing to me that was the first field guide because, there's hundreds of field guides to butterflies and moths and other kinds of insects, but even though there's enormous number of caterpillars, there's very, very little attention to them at all.
Yeah, and sometimes we think of caterpillars as pests because they'll eat right through all the leaves they find.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's pretty much how we think of them, isn't it?
It's funny, just now when you talked about how different their bodies are in those different stages, it made me think almost of the human concept of heaven. We're earthbound and we just eat what we can find, and then suddenly, if we go on to an afterlife, we imagine having this different power and this sort of ability to move about as we choose and do what we choose.
Right. Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's great. And maybe that's why we're so attracted to butterflies as well. They seem so free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You open the book with a chapter called Air, which is this really amazing reminder of how many insects share our environment, even when we're scarcely aware of them.
Yeah, I was very excited when I came across this. In fact, I should say, you know, when I started writing the book, I actually knew very little about insects. I wasn't one of those people who had been obsessed with them my entire life or something like that. So the book was really an exploration for me, just discovering more and more about how amazing they were, in lots of ways, both positive ways and negative ways, actually. And this chapter was about how the air is just full of insects, very, very small insects to very high levels. I mean, people have found spiders that, I know people will say that spiders aren't insects, but spiders and other, let's say spiders and other similar beings, at, you know, up to 15,000 feet.
Which is amazing because they don't fly. They just have to float up there, right?
Isn't it amazing? Yeah, but they have ways of positioning themselves so they get carried by the wind, so that it seems that there's actually, this is very intentional, that insects get themselves taken off. They position themselves against the wind so that they get lifted off, and then they find the air currents, and they can bring themselves down as well. So for a long time, people knew that insects were in the air. Well, once they figured out that insects were way up there in the air, they knew they were there, but they thought they were just getting blown around. But then, more recently, in the last couple of decades, people studying this have started to realize that actually there's insects move. They move in this way because they want to find new habitats, or they just want to move, primarily because they're looking for new resources of one kind or another. And they move these enormous distances. I mean, there really are insects that have circumnavigated the globe like this. And they can bring themselves down as well. So a lot of this is very deliberate. You know, crazy as that sounds, it really is.
And this study in the 20s in Louisiana, where this guy who worked for like the Federal Cotton Insect Investigation Department, he found, was it 36 million insects in a square mile?
They thought that, yeah, the numbers were, I think it was from like 25 to 35 million insects above us in a square mile above this rural Louisiana.
Wow.
And this is in summer, so the numbers are, you know, they're pretty high numbers, but you can assume that there's numbers close to that above all kinds of similar, you know, similar areas. I mean, the air basically is full of insects, and they're, yeah, and as I said, I think they're all going somewhere, and they more or less know where they're going, I think.
And, of course, you know, there's the, like, biblical plague of locusts and different insects. And there are some that will sort of hang back in one place and then get their numbers really huge and then just absolutely tear into the countryside.
Yeah, I mean, and locusts are the famous ones, aren't
yeah.
they? And I have a chapter in the book about some research that I did in Niger in West Africa, where I talked to farmers who had been, whose lands had been invaded by locusts. And also people, they tend to be people more, people I talk to are more people in cities, but also farmers too who also enjoy eating crickets and locusts as well. So people have this very double-edged relationship with these kinds of insects. When they see them coming, you know, it's both terrifying, but at the same time it can be an opportunity for special food that they might normally get to eat. It really depends on the circumstances.
And you're normally a vegan, but you went ahead and tried one. Is that right? Or more than
yeah,
one?
I am normally a vegan, but yeah, you know, sometimes you're in these situations when it just seems too antisocial and too rude to tell people you're not going to eat what people are offering you. So yeah, I did, and they're basically crunchy.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're like a crunchy snack.
So were you able to just not be freaked out by it and just?
Well, or just a little freaked out by it.
And they taste like peanuts.
A little bit more like cheese puffs or something like that. They got that kind of crunchy thing. But people cook them. They boil them and then dry them in the sun, and then fry them with chili and salt and lime. At least that's what they do in Niger.
Mm-hmm.
And locusts are mostly what people will eat there, and crickets. But in other parts of the world, like in northern Thailand, which I haven't actually been to, but there people have a very, very developed insect cuisine. They eat many different kinds of insects and have very, you know, very elaborate ways of preparing them.
We think of insects as universally tiny creatures. I was fascinated in the book to read that when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, bugs were bigger too. There were dragonflies with a 30-inch wingspan.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Over the millennia, insects have basically miniaturized.
Hmm.
And they started out much larger and have just become much smaller, and I suppose more efficient as they become smaller as well. I mean, that's one of the things about, particularly about flying insects. I think they're extremely efficient animals, and you know, they can move. I mean, dragonflies actually have, in evolutionary terms, quite primitive wings and wing attachments. Yet they're tremendously capable flyers and at maneuvering. I mean, as anybody knows who's watched them. Tremendously capable at maneuvering and at positioning themselves, and they actually will catch their prey in flight, unlike most other flying animals. Actually, not many that can do that.
Very few people dislike dragonflies, and the thought of a 30-inch one would be sort of beautiful. But were the ones that we don't like so much that big as well?
I don't know, actually. That's a good question. It's a scary thing to think about, isn't it?
A cockroach the size of a, you know, tennis shoe or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're big enough now, aren't they?
Yeah. you have a chapter called Chernobyl, and in that you introduce us to this fascinating artist who paints very detailed watercolors of insects who have suffered mutations due to radiation exposure.
That's right. Yeah, this is a woman called Cornelia Hesse-Honegger. She's a Swiss artist, and she started as a scientific illustrator working in a lab in Zurich where fruit flies were being irradiated in genetics experiments. So she saw the kinds of mutations that were happening, but she was also very keen amateur insect collector or insect observer, and she was particularly interested in these tiny little beetles. Called true bugs or leaf bugs, and she started to notice, looking at them in her backyard, that there was a high level of deformities that had similarities to the deformities that she was seeing in the flies she was looking at in her lab. So she started, actually, I suppose she started to get a little obsessed with this and about what was going on with whether there was some connection with the kind in. Some causal connection, if there was some reason why they were like that, which was similar to the reasons that she was seeing in the lab. So she started going to nuclear power stations, not places that had accidents, but just regular, well-functioning nuclear power stations in Switzerland. And, you know, incidentally, Swiss nuclear power stations are supposed to be the cleanest in the world. And she started to find this, what she thought of as a very high incidence of deformities in these insects, and there were things like they might have one of their antennae shorter or missing, and they might have missing legs or misshapen wings or something like that. The kind of things that you really wouldn't notice unless you really knew what you were looking at, and unless you were really experienced at looking at them. And she started painting them, and her paintings are very beautiful. They're quite large portraits, very very detailed portraits of these insects that she'd find. And she thinks of her painting as a kind of research, because when she's painting them, she's so focused on the colors and the lines that she doesn't really notice the, you know, what might be deformities until after she's painted them often. And she looks at the painting and she realizes that there's something wrong with the insect. So she would try to get scientists. She was very aware that she wasn't a scientist. She was really, even though she was actually, I think, very expert in these, you know, certainly on what these insects look like and on their behavior, just because she's been looking at them for so long.
Let me interrupt you right there.
Sure,
we need to take a break. Hugh Raffles is my guest. He's professor of anthropology at the New School and author of the book Insectopedia, which has just been released in trade paperback. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Anthropology at the New School, Hugh Raffles. His book is called Insectopedia. It's available now in trade paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. And Hugh, you were telling us before the break about Cornelia Hesse-Honegger, and you were saying that she was trying to attract the attention of scientists to this problem.
That's right, and she really had a lot of trouble doing that. It's only in the last, she's been doing this for 30 years, and it's only in the last couple of years that she's been more successful at doing that, at getting people to take her more seriously. But so instead, she really got taken up by anti-nuclear activists who really took what she was doing very seriously and were very concerned about the effects of nuclear power. And I think Cornelia really felt like this too, that the insects were some kind of indicator of the dangers just from even properly functioning nuclear power stations, that there were these levels of, these sort of low levels of radioactivity could also have an effect on beings in there, around the stations.
Yeah, it's so timely right now as we think about the ramifications from the Japan nuclear disaster, where we're being told at least that the ocean is safely absorbing a lot of this radioactive material, and that will keep everyone safe.
Yeah, it's really very worrying because the level of lack of knowledge, I suppose, is what's most troubling. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of those people who really subscribes to a precautionary principle when there's something that we don't know, we should really be very cautious about proceeding in potentially very dangerous ways.
I have to say, I went online and you have illustrations in the book, but they're in black and white. And so I went online and looked at her paintings, and they are, as you say, just breathtakingly beautiful. And she talks about the fact that she thinks of them as individuals, which is sort of an interesting way to think about insects, because if anything, we imagine them according to their entire species.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And one of the things that I like a lot about her paintings is, they're very striking and they're quite large. And so you really do have to confront they're like portraits. And so you really do confront the insects as individuals. And that really shifts the way you think about them. A lot of the people who I met in writing the book who studied, you either collected or studied insects, said that just one of the great things about doing that is that it changes the way that you you pay attention, because you're focusing on these very, very tiny things. You get much more sensitive to small differences and think less in terms of, big generalizations and pay more attention to just the... It trains you to pay more attention to individual difference and just what, how tiny things can really matter in the lives of both these tiny little insects, but then, by implication to all of us as well.
Of course, the irony here is that the vast majority of people who respect and collect insects are, in fact, not collecting them alive. They're collecting corpses.
That's right. I know. And I met one person in Japan where I did some fieldwork who collects insects but doesn't kill them. So it's only when they die that he puts them into his collection. He keeps them, and he's one of these people who has a very, very, very impressive collection. But yeah, most people kill them, and Cornelia talks about this, how she eventually just gets sickened by killing so many of them because she develops this very intimate relationship with them.
The most, I guess, intimate relationships we see in the book are in this chapter that you called Generosity, the Happy Times, which is, you open up this amazing world of Chinese cricket fighting. For a certain generation, this is a really serious hobby.
Very serious. I mean, I think it's mostly men, and particularly for men probably now in their 40s and above, it's extremely serious. And people have been doing this for really a long time. I mean, maybe 1,000 years. And now there are millions, literally millions of people, I think, involved in it. And people collect and they buy and they collect and they raise crickets, which they then fight against each other. And some people do it in a very sort of like as a hobby, and other people do it in a much more serious way. And there's usually some gambling involved in it, which is, I think, one of the incentives as well. So it's really, it's pretty amazing, and that was probably my favorite fieldwork that I did in the book.
What makes for a good fighting cricket?
Oh, you know, I wish I could really, I really knew that. I mean, people have been doing this for a long time, debate this very intensely, you know, what makes one cricket better than another. But it's, and they have, you know, they have their own ways of saying, of knowing. But really, I mean, it's basically, you know, the strength of the cricket and its agility and that kind of thing. But it's also something that people call its fighting spirit, which, you know, I guess is self-explanatory, but it's the, I don't know, like the combativeness and the resilience of the cricket. So it's the cricket's personality, really, that it's willing to not just be aggressive, but also to be a bit strategic as well.
Yeah, I liked bending my mind around the idea that people would know these insects well enough to determine that this one had a different personality than that one.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? And people really train them, though, and so they work closely with them. And people who are really good at this can get the cricket to respond to verbal commands. You know, it's a combination of verbal and also they have these little straws that they will stroke the cricket with.
Mm-hmm.
But they can, this one man demonstrated this for me by telling the cricket to, you know, turn left, turn right, turn left, turn right, and actually the cricket responded. It was a little,
wow,
very, very impressive.
And at one point they said they asked you to go ahead and try and exercise this cricket's jaws. Is that right?
Yeah, and you know, it's just I was completely hopeless at that. You know, it's very sophisticated and subtle. You know, people are really, really extremely good about that. Are good at this. People who do this are real experts. Really are.
And a good romp in the hay is good for a cricket before a match.
Apparently so. Yeah.
Are there like cricket concubines? So do they buy male ones and have a few females for copulation purposes?
Yeah, they do. And because the males are the fighters, those are the ones that really go for a lot of money. And the females are pretty much there to. Unfortunately, the role of the females in this world is to service the male crickets and just just facilitate, make them better fighters.
You know what I was wondering about, Hugh, is after a while, it would seem like if you've invested all this time and money in a cricket, you'd be so fond of it, you wouldn't want to risk its life by letting it fight.
Yeah, that's a good point. But on the other hand, I suppose you'd want to take the risk because you'd want to bring more glory on the cricket if you have that confidence in it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there are people who, you know, if they don't have confidence that cricket is going to have a good chance in that fight, then they won't. They'll protect it and not let it into the arena. I don't know if people get really sentimental about their crickets.
And what does it take to watch a match? Because they're so tiny. I mean, is there just eight people looking on as this sort of thing happens?
Well, matches happen in different circumstances. If you go to markets where people are selling crickets, then there are a lot of sort of informal exhibition matches where you'll see a lot of men crowded around this little plastic arena that the crickets are fighting in, and everyone's just crowding around trying to see what's happening. And that's really to increase the value of a cricket. People selling the crickets will just set this up to increase the value of a cricket so that people will be more interested in buying it. So you get those kinds of situations where you can see crickets fighting. Then you get exhibition matches where there isn't really any gambling, and it's more for the promotion of the traditional Chinese culture, something like that. And there are people who are very keen on promoting that and who set up those kinds of exhibition matches. And sometimes those are in private homes, and other times they're more public. And then you have probably the most common of these are the cricket fights, which are associated with gambling, which are basically like casinos, except that it's or like cockfights or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, because gambling is illegal in China, those are very much underground. And those will be invited. People who go to those are invited, and you have to know where they are. And it's a circle of people, and you know, then people are admitted because people have to be quite cautious about that because of the police. And then you'll get a lot of people. You have a lot of people in a room, and it's very, very, very exciting and very active. And you know, there's a lot of money flying around, and it's very tense because there's all this money being waged on the crickets. And there'll be a lot of people crowding around this long table. And really, I think only the ones closest can really see what's happening. You can see how it's going to end how it ends, because it's very obvious, because the losing cricket, even if it hasn't been injured, looks very, very deflated, you know, and sort of humiliated and just sort of, I don't know, like limps away, whereas the other cricket gets all puffed up and sings and looks very, very pleased with itself. Really, it looks pretty much like a boxing match. You know?
Is it any less disturbing to watch crickets being forced to fight than it would be to watch something like a dog fight or a cockfight?
Well, it's strange, actually. Well, it's strange for me because I was very conscious of, you know, I'm somebody who's very very conscious of cruelty to animals, mm-hmm. and I became very very sensitive to insects and to the ways in which they're just dismissed and not even treated as animals. People often just don't think of them as animals; they think of them as something else. I'm not sure exactly what, you know, bugs, I guess. But there's something so captivating about cricket fight, and crickets are so, they're sort of amazing to watch. They move really, really fast, and they're very, very elegant, and they're just, it's very, just very compelling to watch it. But it was only when the cricket fights had finished, and I finished watching them, that I'd start thinking about that and the ways that I'd just forgotten all about that. Because actually it is pretty disturbing in some ways. You know, they're kept in captivity. They're treated very, very well whilst they're in captivity. But they're trained to fight, and then they're put there, and the whole point is that they, you know, attack and damage each other. Mm. So, yeah, it does have that, at least that aspect of, I don't know what the word for it would be, but something like, you know, they're just completely controlled and manipulated, I suppose.
You talk about being more sensitive to insects and sort of noticing them in a different way. And I really love when you write about what we call cockroaches and you generously call water bugs in your apartment in New York. And you describe this one where her face is angular and inquisitive, this roach that you see on a stack of books in the middle of the night.
Yeah, yeah, and it was a bit, you know, I really don't like them. I think, like most people, I don't like having them in my house. I don't actually mind the little ones, but, you know, when they're these big ones that I call water bugs, you know, yeah, that can fly as well. I'm sure you have more.
We know cockroaches here, yeah.
you know a lot more about them than I do, more intimidating ones probably. But, you know, in the enclosed space of a New York apartment like I live in, they're pretty, you know, they move about so fast. They're bothersome, you know,
yeah.
At least to me. But sometimes, you know, you find yourself in a situation where, in this case, I was sort of like eye to eye with this one, so you just suddenly turn around and hadn't expected it. And so instead of just seeing, you know, just seeing that sort of generic roach, I actually found myself looking at it and seeing it as, I suppose, seeing it as an animal, like looking at it eye to eye and really seeing its head and its face. And it was just, yeah, doing that thing where they, you know, they move their head from side to side, and who knows if they're looking at you, but they look as if they're looking at you,
mm-hmm.
you know.
It's funny how much they can freak us out. We're, you know, a thousand yeah. times their size, and they're not going to do us any harm.
And there's something about it, isn't there, that the scale changes when you see that, and they don't seem like they're tiny little things, which they are, but they seem huge
mm-hmm.
because you get freaked out by them.
And they make that noise when you hear them kind of skittering across stuff.
And it's even and then when you do actually squash them, which I hate doing, but when you do and they don't die, their legs keep going, and it's just awful.
Yeah.
It's just awful.
Yeah. And you try to put them outside if you possibly can?
Yeah, if I can. I've tried to develop methods for doing that. I actually would just let them be, but, and she'll hate me saying this, but my wife really hates them. She gets really, really freaked out by them. So, you know, and that gets me freaked out by them, and then we just have, like, chaos, you know, and then I'm running around trying to kill them, and I can't pretend that I've killed them when I have them, because, you know, they'll just come back, and it's terrible.
Yeah, yeah, you can't toss one in the trash if it's not already dead.
Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest this hour is Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia. Let's go on the phones to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. You know, I've eaten a lot of grasshoppers because we got into it as Boy Scouts, and they taste like pecans to me.
Oh, really?
As they're fresh, you know, I mean, if they're alive still.
Oh.
They taste very pecan-y, and I love them. But I was going to, you know, crickets in Texas, I don't know if they do this other places, but they swarm at certain times of year.
Yeah.
And they create a mat of crickets that is impossible to walk on. It's so slick, it's like walking on ice.
Yeah.
And they shut down intersections at various places because cars can't stop.
Wow, I've never experienced that. That's really interesting.
Go to Austin, you'll experience that. They're all over the place.
Does that happen every year?
I'm sorry?
Does that happen every year?
It happens, yes. It's a regular thing. It happens here in Dallas as well, but I'm trying to remember exactly when. It's usually late spring. It's in the warming up period, and all of a sudden they're here, and they're just create mats of crickets by the millions, it seems like. So that is another bizarre phenomena that happens with the bugs around here.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
And also, thanks for this show. This is very interesting.
Well, thanks for your call, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, dear.
Thanks a lot.
You know, there's also something you can see like one or two of one sort of insect and they don't seem so threatening, but somehow when there are a lot of them around, and a lot of people feel this way about bees, you know?
Yeah.
You don't mind seeing one or two, but if you see the hive or a swarm, that's really, really terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about how insects are very unpredictable. It's this thing you feel like they don't, I don't know, it's that they don't respond to you in the way
they don't follow
that
our rules,
animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have some great information here, and we've talked on the show about all that's been learned about the way that insects communicate, bees in particular, and their little dances.
Yeah, it's quite an amazing thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And if you've had this on the show before?
Yeah, we had a whole show about bees, and it was really fascinating because you just don't think about it.
No, and the more you think about bees, the more interesting they are.
Yeah,
because I think a lot of people think about their communication as if it's this very mechanical thing, that, you know, they dance and that dance communicates a location and a distance of where a source of food source is, and then they just get that information and sort of compute it and then go out there. But it seems that there's sort of a lot of debate and discussion and decision that goes on. So they put the information out there, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the bee that gets that information is going to act on that. There's actually a lot of decision that goes on. They decide if they're going to go there or if they're going to go somewhere else, and they listen. The bees that are in the hive might listen to several bees before they decide where they're going to go. So they're really very, very fascinating animals. One of the things that really strikes me about
bees... I'm sorry, Hugh. Let me stop you once more.
We have to take another break.
Hugh Raffles is my guest. He's professor of anthropology at the New School and author of Insectopedia. The book is out now in trade paperback. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Hugh Raffles, professor of anthropology at the New School and author of Insectopedia. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or online at think@kera.org. You were telling us before the break, Hugh, about the democracy of bee colonies.
Yeah, and one of the things that that's really struck me about this is that, you know, bees have these tiny brains. I mean, their brains can fit on the size of a pinhead. And yet they have these very sophisticated societies and these, like you said, democracy. And they really engage in a lot of debate before they and decision making. So I've often thought about this idea that, you know, that one of the distinctive things about humans is that we have these huge brains and that we sort of correlate brain size with intelligence. And It just makes me think that maybe that's not really the way to think about this.
We maybe have a human-centric bias there.
We might do, yeah.
You know, of course, we love our honeybees in this country and want to protect them, but they are not native to North America.
No, they're not. They're a European species that came here, in the 1600s, and they've come here many times since. Different varieties and strains have come here many times since. We've grown to love them, even though they're not native. I don't think of them as native, I think, at this point.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Joseph in Weatherford. Hi, Joseph.
Hi.
Hi, Joseph.
I just had a quick comment. I love this show, by the way.
Thanks.
But I was working outside not too long ago, and I noticed that there were quite a few number of bees in the area, and they were, I don't know what kind of bees they were, but around here, you know, you get the stories of the African killer bees and stuff. So, of course, there's this slight fear, but especially whenever they're everywhere. So I was wearing a red bandana, and, of course, I started getting some curious bees around my head. And so unconsciously, I just started swatting at them, and they would go away, and then they'd come back. And before I knew it, I'm swatting and swatting, not flailing, but just, you know, I'm swatting at them, and there's just a whole number of bees, quite a few. And so what happened was I decided to calm down, and...
No, thank you, though. I'm all right.
Sorry, I'm on the side of the road. This old man pulled up, want to know if I was broke down.
It's okay. You know, I'm glad you pulled over. That's a much safer way to do it. Did you get stung, Joseph?
No, actually, I decided to change my focus. So I figured if I would just calm down, you know, and sort of be with the bees, then maybe they would calm down too. And sure enough, within a matter of moments, they left me alone. It was really remarkable. There were a lot of bees around me. So it was kind of hard to do, you know, to work in this environment. But yeah, as soon as I just breathed, you know. it was pretty incredible.
That's really interesting. What do you think about that, Hugh?
I think that's a great story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Because, I mean, I guess what it makes you think is that their aggressive behavior is defensive, really. And that they're not actually really interested in attacking you, only in defending what seems like a threat. But also it makes me think that your calmness then communicates to them as well. I've found the same thing, that often if we just take our time and don't sort of lash out instinctively, which is, you know, often what we do with insects, and because we seem to be scared of them, but just like take our time and be calm, then we have the same kind of response. Although, you know, it takes a lot to do that when you're surrounded by bees. That's pretty impressive.
Now, we're not so scared of mosquitoes, but we sure don't like them. Very few people are calm in their presence.
No, and mosquitoes are really predators on us, aren't they? So maybe it's a little different.
Yeah. And in certain parts of the world, they are like truly dangerous because they carry really serious diseases, like malaria.
Yeah. They really are. And then the issue is what the best way is to control them, I think. And it seems, you know, there's a lot of debate and discussion right now about whether genetically modified mosquitoes are, you know, which a lot of the research at the moment is on creating genetically modified mosquitoes. And there's a lot of people who think that this isn't a very smart way to go. I mean, for the obvious reasons that we don't really know what's going to happen once those get released into, outside a lab or into the wild. Mm-hmm. And instead, people prefer, you know, some of these more preventive methods like treated mosquito nets and just things just to remove mosquito habitats, emptying water, still water, and things like this.
And the problem is in malaria regions, right, that you can you get bitten once and then you have to be bitten again by an infected mosquito, and it sort of starts the cycle all over again. Is that right?
It's very dangerous. I the first when we started this conversation, I was telling you about being in the Amazon, and, and the area that I was in then was a malarial area, and because the river would flood every year, and every winter people would have real problems with malaria. Pretty much everybody had malaria, and it would come back often. Every year, maybe it would come back, or during the year. At times of stress, people develop the symptoms, and it's just really debilitating, really, because it just makes people weaker, and people have very hard physical lives anyway in those kind of places.
Yeah.
And so it makes people much weaker. And, you know, obviously also, you know, a lot of people would die. Where I was, people, you know, from time to time people would die, particularly older people or children or people who were sick could get very, very sick.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Sam on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Sam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really enjoy the show. Can't wait to read this book. My question is about insect conservation. The late Thomas Eisner, he just died just recently, unfortunately, wrote a book called For Love of Insects, which is a fantastic book. And I'm curious, you know, we were just talking about mosquitoes and bees, some of the more famous bugs. But in your research, did you find out maybe more of an appreciation of the diversity of insects, and not just the diversity, but their conservation?
So you mean for myself, did I find that?
Yeah, in your research in this book, or personally.
Yeah, what I found, I think, more because of the, you know, because of the people that I chose to speak, chose to talk to, I found more that people, I met more people who were, who felt that they had learned something about the world in general from collecting or studying or working with insects in some way. You know, that being around insects had taught them to appreciate the world more and to look at the world differently. Most of the people I met who were collecting insects had a fairly narrow focus. You know, they might have collected all different kinds of weevils, something like that. Or like Cornelia, who I talked about, you know, she was very, very focused on these true bugs. And that's, you know, that's a very diverse group of animals, but it's really, say, only one, you know, only one one classification category. So I didn't really meet people who, or talk to people, and because I'm not an entomologist myself, I don't really have that, you know, that breadth of knowledge. And I didn't really meet people who were like Thomas Eisner, you know, who are just these really, like you said, really amazing experts. The people who I talked to were very much experts, but were experts in a more narrow field. So I had a sense of this tremendous, tremendous diversity and the, and I suppose the, yeah, maybe the, I'm trying to talk about conservation. Conservation is really hard with insects, partly because there are so many, I mean, what we know is how many insects we don't know. I mean, people know in principle that there are thousands and thousands of species that we just haven't found or identified. But that's mostly what they know. They sort of know what they don't know.
The book has been hugely successful now, multiple printings, and now we've got the trade paperback edition. But I have to ask you, was your publisher instantly on board with the concept, or did it take some explaining about what you were going to do?
No, they were very, very excited about it, and very, very supportive, and they let me go in the direction that I wanted to. And they gave me plenty. It took me quite a long time to write, and they gave me plenty of time to write. And the editor that I had was just tremendously supportive and helpful. So, yeah, I had a very, very good experience with my publisher, yeah.
I think maybe the most bizarre chapter in the book is the one called Sex, and it's not about sex among insects, but about people who have this fantasy of being crushed like an insect, and they find that to be a turn-on.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, this is about, it's about people who make movies of women stepping on insects. So really the movies are just of either of the woman's face and her talking, or else of her photo filmed from, you know, from the knees down mostly.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not, you know, porn movies in any conventional sense. You know, they're fetish movies. And the reason I was interested in it was because I thought it was one of those situations where people really, really identified with the insect, and just had a different kind of relationship with it. And people certainly do identify with the insect, but what they're really identifying with is with being, I think, with being humiliated and being treated in a very, treated as if they're very worthless. So what they're identifying with is with the insect as a worthless being.
Yeah, they're not thinking about butterflies.
No, they're not. And they're not even, in some ways, what I decided in the end was they're not really even thinking about the insects. They're just thinking about the insects as, if you like, a representative of, you know, worthlessness, something like that.
Did it make you sad?
Yeah, it did make me sad. And it made me sad, actually, because the people who I met, I really liked them. I thought they were really interesting people.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it made me much more tolerant, actually, because, you know, I thought, you know, they were very interesting, very smart people, and they weren't doing a lot of good for the insects, although it's, you know, a relatively small number of insects, you could say. But they really weren't doing anybody else any harm, I didn't think. Yet they've been treated very, very badly in the press over the years, and really sort of hounded as freaks and as, you know, just really people who have this really unacceptable behavior. But actually, the behavior, I think, is more about their own sense of, you know, their own sense of themselves than it is about anything else.
It's funny, yeah, the same people who would have no problem, you know, emptying a can of Raid in their own kitchen somehow were outraged by this. You had Mickey Rooney, the actor, testifying before Congress that this should be stopped.
Exactly, and somebody who I talked to said that they felt this was really hypocritical in a society that was, you know, that was so hostile to insects and that really had no, or to animals in general, that had no difficulty in, you know, having these mass industries of killing animals. But when it was... When killing was connected to pleasure and to sex, then people got you know, just completely outraged, even though it was on this very small scale.
Do you think that our distant ancestors probably knew a lot more about insects than we do?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. We live in such a sanitized, controlled environment. We're so out of touch with them. And maybe it's different in Texas. Maybe people are, you know, closer to the outdoors. At least, you know, outside cities. I don't know. I imagine it. You know, this is my New York idea. You know, that because you're in a hotter climate, and that some people have this, you know, just closer to insect life than we are here.
Well, it is everywhere, but we I think are just as outraged to find them in our kitchens and our bathroom drains as anybody else.
Okay.
Yeah. Why do you think kids are so fascinated and then suddenly take on this revulsion that adults seem to almost universally hold?
Well, I think it's because we teach them to be that way.
Yeah,
you know, we express our own fear and you know, disdain for insects. That you know, that communicates to kids, and they learn that. So their initial curiosity that they might have, you know, just gives way to disgust and to just a sort of intolerance. Actually, that's one of the things that you see developing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that I think is very sad, yeah.
I think people should know, you know, who might be interested in the book, there's really nothing in it to disgust one. You know, those who might be squeamish about insects could pick this up, I think, and read it and not be scared away.
I think so. I mean, maybe, you know, sometimes I sort of reflect on that disgust and try to understand it, but I don't think there's anything that's going to make you... No, there's nothing that's going to be scary in the book at all. I don't think so. You know, because I'm a bit squeamish myself, so...
Do you have a favorite insect?
Yeah, I do. Well, actually, two after writing the book, bees and crickets. I grew to just love both of them. And I think maybe particularly bees, because they're just so amazing. The more time you spend thinking about them or being with them, they're just endlessly fascinating and endlessly endlessly interesting.
Hugh Raffles is professor of anthropology at the New School. His most recent book, Insectopedia, has just been released in trade paperback. Hugh, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending the time with us.
I really enjoyed it, Chris. Thank you very much indeed.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.